Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Kimberly Saavedra, Director of the Comlock Center in California, and I'm here with Dr. Betty Kovach, author of The Miracle of Death and her forthcoming book, The Merchants of Light.
Hey, thank you, Kim. We feel that we're very fortunate today to have our guest, who is Dr. Antonio Mills. She is going to be talking with us for the hour about her work on the beliefs in and evidence for reincarnation among the First Nations of British Columbia in Canada and in India. I just want to say to the listeners, hang on, because you are going to hear some very interesting stories. I've spent the last week or two looking through some of her research, and I'm absolutely fascinated with it. And you will be too. Dr. Mills has a BA degree from Harvard University, and she also has her PhD degree from Harvard in cultural anthropology and child development. Now, I'm going to give you the dissertation that she wrote for her PhD because it really fascinated me, and I hope that during the hour we'll have just a few moments for Dr. Mills to tell us a little bit about it. The title is The Beaver Indian Prophet Dance and Related Movements Among North American Indians. I have to say that I had not known very much about the First Nations of British Columbia, and Dr. Mills has just opened this up for me in a way that that I'm very grateful for, and I think she will do the same for you. She is professor at the University of Northern British Columbia in Canada in First Nations Studies.
She has been there. Professor Emerita.
Professor Emerita.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yes, Emerita, that's right. She surely is. But you're still teaching, right? You are still there, right?
Yes, I am. I still have an office there, but I'm not teaching courses currently.
Oh, I am good. Okay. Well, I think you've also worked at the University of Virginia in the Division of Personality Studies for 6 years between 1988 and 1994. And I know that this probably had to do with your connection to Dr. Ian Stevenson, which you'll be telling us about later. Dr. Mills has received postdoctoral grants for field research from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, as well as the University of Virginia's Division of Personality Studies. There may have been other grants, but those are the ones that I found. Publications include her co-editing of a book. The title is Amerindian Rebirth, Reincarnation Beliefs Among North American Indians and Inuit. She has also contributed two chapters to that book. And she's published extensive articles in scholarly journals about her research in First Nations. And the research is extremely interesting. It's very professionally done, obviously. It's a scholarly done, but it's also so readable and interesting. She has done work on the First Nations land claims, religion, laws, reincarnation. But before we get to that, I want to say to you, Dr. Mills, first of all, to a very warm welcome from us, and also that I saw, while I was preparing for this interview, I watched a YouTube of an interview with you about your work in the First Nations studies, and you were so inspired about it, and you inspired me, even though I couldn't hear the video too well, but I could hear some of what your work is about in the First Nations studies. And I just wonder if you would tell us a little bit about that, because that would help us and our listeners to get to know the people you've been working with. I really came to have a very close feeling to them through your work. So could you tell us what you do at the University of British Columbia in First Nations Studies?
Well, like I say, I am Professor Emerita, Emeritus. I retired a year ago, but I have really enjoyed, even long before I came to UNBC in 1994, working with the First Nations people in British Columbia, Canada. I came to the Beaver Indians way back in 1964. I just graduated with my undergrad, and I'd married a grad student, and he was, further along in his PhD, and I was going on to my PhD. And we went to the Beaver Indians in northeastern BC, the Dene Za, and we were adopted by them way back in 64. And they just introduced me to so much that was so rich. They had a living prophet. You mentioned my PhD thesis being about the Beaver Indian prophet dance and related movements among North American Indians. And that was just wonderful to learn all about the prophet and the prophet tradition and their whole way of life there, which included belief in reincarnation. And I had never learned in any courses that I'd taken on North American Indian spirituality or religion kinds of things, that was a part of the spiritual beliefs of North American Indians. But we learned from the Beaver Indians that both about human reincarnation, but also that they take the life of every animal that they take, whether it's a rabbit or a moose or fish, so that it will want to come back and feed them again.
And yes, I was impressed with that. That was really beautiful.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. It's a very caring kind of tradition. It's very important. It's establishing a positive relationship with all the other life forms, which is very, very important. Something I hope our whole world starts to do.
Well, that's absolutely, and that's where your research is so important, is that the people, the animals, the plants, we're all part of this life force and the planet, and that to treat it lovingly and respectfully will make it all want to come back again and continue.
Yeah, this is poignant because right now in the Standing Rock Sioux, have this huge standoff. They're trying to protect their water from a pipeline that's bringing oil that has leaked in a lot of places already from coming into their territory. And I just saw this morning the wonderful YouTube that, with all the police brutality from dogs and police with pepper spray and everything else and
rubber bullets.
Yes, but a whole herd of the buffalo came just recently.
I heard that, but I didn't, only from a friend, and I didn't find it. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's so beautiful. You can find a YouTube on it.
I love
my Facebook page now. And it's the response of all of the Standing Rock Sioux and was so wonderful. They were singing, calling out to the buffalo with such joy and appreciation. And all of those armed guards who had really quite violent and cruel to the people, were turning to look at the buffalo. What a remarkable event.
Well, that really does give indication of the connection between the people and the animals.
Absolutely. It's just, it's poignant. It's very poignant.
Well, I think that that entire situation is such a metaphor for the two cultures, is that there the native peoples were chanting and smudging with sweetgrass and I think sage and praying. And here was the other coming with violence.
Really? Yes, yes, with, you know, I guess they were rubber bullets, but still, you know, and pepper spray and these dogs that I don't, that bit so many of the poor people.
They did.
And, you know, so they were bleeding and hurt, all kinds of things. Yes. So,
yes, and they had no weapons. They had to know that the native peoples had no weapons.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So I think it's very important that people appreciate that this is a part of Native North American Indian tradition, and that reincarnation is a very deep part of it as well.
Yes.
And treating people and animals and all life forms so that they will come back and nourish one another over and over and over again. Such an important concept.
Yes, and you did a considerable amount of work on their relationship, the First Nations relationship to the land. That's always been very difficult for Westerners to understand, that Native peoples have a deep and profound and sacred relationship to the land. But your work takes it, of course, giant step further in the reincarnation. But I wanted to ask you before we go to that, what exactly was the prophet dance?
Well, I'll talk both about the prophet dance and just then touch on the Delgamuukw land claims court case. The prophet dance is still practiced today by the Beaver Indians of northeastern British Columbia. It's a dance that came from the visions that the Beaver Indian prophets had, which began before white man came to their area. And Charlie Yahe was the last Beaver Indian prophet who passed away in 1976. But they had these premonitions that these dangers were coming to them, and they had to look after the well-being of all life forms and all animals, and that if they are not able to protect all the life forms and the animals, this fourth world, they see this as the fourth world, will come to an end.
Well, and I just heard a statistic from the wildlife, I'm not sure the exact name of the organization, that by 2020, two-thirds of the wildlife would be extinct. Seems like a very large percentage.
Terrific. Yes, yes. I mean, with climate change is coming on at a pace that we never anticipated, and the damage to the environment is huge. It's really horrific. Where I am in British Columbia, Canada, the mountain pine beetle kill is huge because there's been so much change in the climate due to clear cut forestry, which the First Nations have been opposed to forever. And that leads me to the Delgamuukw case, because it was largely because of all the damage that was being done to their territory once clear cut forestry became the standard practice, that the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en First Nations, who are in the Gitxsan are Northwest Coast people in sort of central western British Columbia, Canada, and the Wet'suwet'en are just to their east. They took the Delgamuukw land claims court case because they wanted to assert they had never given up rights to their traditional territory, and they were very distressed about the decimation that was happening to their territory through clear-cut logging. So one of the books that I've published is called Eagle Down is Our Law with Wet'suwet'en Law, Feast and Land Claims.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that, Dr. Mills.
The name of the book that came out of my work for the Gitan Wet'suwet'en Tribal Council, with the Wet'suwet'en particularly, was called Eagle Down is Our Law, Wet'suwet'en Law, Feasts, and Land Claims.
I see. It strikes me in reading your work that the kind of work that you've done on Indigenous peoples, our Native peoples throughout the Americas, really. I mean, yours has been concentrated in British Columbia, but they really do hold a secret for our survival. So your work is not just interesting in reincarnation studies, but it really is interesting for the next phase of our development, I think.
Well said. Thank you for recognizing that. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Now, what kind of studies are done at First Nations Studies?
Well, First Nations Studies is a degree, you know, at some places it's called Indigenous Studies, but at University of Northern British Columbia it's called First Nations Studies. And we offer courses in all kinds of aspects, from language, which contains an immense amount of wisdom in their traditional languages, and we teach some of the languages of this area, to contemporary politics, all kinds of aspects of culture and concerns about the environment. Indeed, part of the courses that are taught. Absolutely. I also created a course called Indigenous Perspectives on Reincarnation and Rebirth.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, I don't know whether it was a potlatch or a ceremony that the university had, or the special studies sponsored, and various things were done, but you mentioned just briefly that some of the nations talked about their medicine, their natural medicine.
Yes. You know, I've taught courses on traditional medicines, picking and preserving, for example. And I have often had, when I teach some of these courses, I have a local elder woman, Grace Rossetti, co-teach the courses with me. She is a remarkable person. I mean, she knows the uses of all the medicines for healing things, and that's something that I've been into since I first became a mother and look after my children. And she also is recognized as a very important chief for the Natkazli people to the west of here, Chief Kwa reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on a booklet or about that as well, she and I.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I think there again, the Western culture is struggling very hard to reclaim a knowledge in natural medicine. And once again, so much information and wisdom lies with our Native peoples about that.
A concern for them, they don't want them to become picked up and used by pharmaceutical companies that are making huge profits, et cetera, et cetera. It's a trick to have them properly respected and used appropriately.
Yes, and I am pleased that there are quite a few doctors today who really, in Western culture, who are not interested in that either, and they are working on natural medicine, and they feel that they are actually shifting the paradigm. So they need to be in touch also with Native peoples to help them in that, because they're not at all interested in the pharmaceutical business, but they are interested in natural healing. But
mm-hmm.
Kim has a question she wants to ask you, too.
I do, Dr. Mills. What would you say is the strongest evidence for reincarnation? And would you please share a couple of your most compelling case studies?
Sure. The compelling evidence is the very clear memories that some children have of a previous life. And I should say that, you know, this happens in India and among the First Nations people, et cetera, and all around the world, you know, in Australia and among Indigenous peoples, you know, elsewhere. But I should also say that it doesn't all happen with every child. It's more frequent among Indigenous peoples than it is in India. But in India, you know, a study was done in an area where there are a lot of cases, and it's, you know, basically there was 1 in 500 children that talks about a previous life. So it's, but what is so compelling is that the children, you know, speak, and make recognitions. Sometimes they have very poignant birthmarks that come from an accident that happened to them in the previous life. Often it was, you know, the fatal accident that brought the former life to an end. And they have, you know, clear memories, special knowledge, et cetera, et cetera, likes and dislikes and recognitions of people and places and things. Yes. Yeah. It's strong.
Yes.
Ian Stevenson is the psychiatrist who developed reincarnation studies. He was a remarkable psychiatrist who was hired at the University of Virginia at the age of 39 to be chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia, which is remarkable, because he was such a wonderful.
Is remarkable.
Wrote so beautifully, but he was very interested in reincarnation and did a lot of studies. And he did so many studies. He was then gifted $1 million by Chester Carlson, the man who invented the Xerox machine, which is kind of neat because that's making copies, and reincarnation is kind of like a copy too. And as a result, he passed on the role of being chair of the Department of Psychiatry and established the division of what was called personality studies and now perceptual studies at the University of Virginia, and did an immense amount of study of reincarnation cases all over the world, you know, India, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand. Some of his earliest studies were with the Tlingit and the Haida and the Inuit, you know, First Nations, Indigenous peoples in North America. That's how I met him.
Mm-hmm. And
shall I go on about that?
Yes, do, because that would be interesting to see how you and he were connected.
Right. I had included, you know, the belief in reincarnation in my PhD thesis with the Beaver Indians, about the Beaver Indian prophet dance, and in my thesis I noted that it was one of the tenets of their spiritual belief, and in that thesis I also looked to see whether the First Nation in the quote-unquote 10 different culture areas of North America had the same beliefs, and reincarnation was noted particularly for taking animals so that they would want to come back and feed you, you know, in all those different culture areas. There was less information that I found at that time on human reincarnation. Since then, there's an appendix in the book Amerindian Rebirth that documents all the different kinds of beliefs among all the different First Nations, Indigenous peoples, Indians of North America, that it has amplified that amount. But Ian Stevenson had come in 1984, 20 years after I'd been adopted by the Beaver Indians, to do a study of reincarnation among the Gitxsan First Nations in British Columbia. And some people he wanted to see were out of town or away, and he went to UBC before he went back to the University of Virginia and asked if there would be anybody who'd be interested in carrying on his research. And he was given my name and I hit, so we actually met before he flew back. And I had not previously heard about his work, but learning about his very, very careful case-by-case study, I was just intrigued. And he said, asked me if I would go and study of reincarnation with the Gitxsan First Nations. And I explained that I was already planning to go to do a different project with the Beaver Indians, but I would be glad to use his methods both with Beaver Indians and with the Gitxsan. So I did that, and it was wonderfully, wonderfully, wonderfully rich in going back to the Beaver and finding about all the people that had come back. And then
I know, I love the stories. You'll have to tell us some of those stories.
Okay.
And, yeah, so that people can get an idea of, I think that while we're at it, though, didn't Stevenson want to know if you did that kind of work using his methods, that what kind of conclusions or results you'd come up with, if that would verify and support his work? And it did. Is that right?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. Yes, in 1 week, when I went to the Gitxsan, who I knew as a kind of a proud First Nations, the West Coast First Nations have a lot of pride. And so I went to the Gitxsan, it was then the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en Tribal Council, to ask for permission. And I was given permission. And in fact, the head person there told me about some cases. And in 1 week, I learned about 33 rich cases. And in fact, I think it was that work that I did that not only caused Ian Stevenson to send me to India and then hire me at the University of Virginia, but it was also, it was that work that meant that the next year they hired me to work for the land claims case, the Delgamuukw land claims court case, because they said this is very important to us. And then after I'd accepted the job, I learned that I had received the postdoctoral fellowship that you mentioned that I had applied to for from SHRC, Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada. And I'd applied to do it with the Beaver Indians and the Gitxsan, but since I'd already accepted the job working with the Wet'suwet'en, SHRC was fine with me switching to the Gitxsan and the Wet'suwet'en. And they said, we're not just taking this court case because we've been here thousands of years, but because we come lifetime after lifetime, come back lifetime after lifetime.
Yeah, that was beautiful. How was that said? Kim and I were impressed.
I wrote that down, that they have lived on the land for thousands of years. They protected the lands, and they come back lifetime after lifetime to continue protecting it.
Mm-hmm. It was so beautiful that the Standing Rock Sioux also insisted they are not protesters, they are protectors of the land.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was, Kim and I both, we wrote that down because we thought that was so beautiful, mm-hmm. that they are so connected to the land.
The complete parallel between what the Delgamuukw and Wet'suwet'en were doing in the Delgamuukw land claims court case and what the Standing Rock Sioux were doing. Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead.
And I'm glad to say that the Tlingit first, no, not Tlingit, the Chilcotin, or which used to be called the Chilcotin First Nation in British Columbia, won a very important land claim. They were also protecting their land against clear cutting, and they got a very clear yes from the Supreme Court of Canada.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
That only happened in 2014, but it's a wonderful and strong precedent.
Oh, that is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Was case that you were representing, or was that another one, or working with as consultant?
No, I was not part of that case, but they were following the practices that had been developed for the Delgamuukw case.
That's good, yeah.
These wise elders speaking their wisdom and knowledge.
Oh, that's
Dr. Mills, will you share a couple of the compelling case studies with our listeners, please?
Yeah, we have time for some detail. I think it's a detail that's so convincing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any cases that you're thinking of in particular?
You know,
but, well, how about we both started this. I mean, go ahead.
Well, the last that I had read were the article that you'd sent about the Indian cases.
Uh-huh.
With Rina and Ashok and, I don't know, all three of them are fascinating.
Well,
just
I'm not sure if I'm picking up on which cases that you're talking about, but so let me talk about a case that's very strong, of Nathan. It's interesting that one of the qualities of especially First Nations reincarnation is that sometimes people will make a prediction before they pass away even about
mm-hmm.
when and how they will come back. And often people will have dreams about who is coming back fairly close to the time of the birth of the person coming back. And I could tell a funny story about a prediction, but I'll go on to this case of Nathan. And Nathan's grandfather had a dream in which his grandfather's father came to him in the dream and said, "I'm coming back to you guys by Raven." And Raven was the daughter of Nathan's grandfather. And so he expected when she had her baby, it would be his father come back. And indeed, Raven gave birth to a baby boy. And this baby boy had a birthmark on his chest, on just to the right of the center part, that he, as a little baby, he would just point to it, point to it, point to it, point to it, you know, notice this, notice, make sure you know who I am, he was saying. And it was something that was, you know, noticed at birth, and then he pointed it out over and over. Nathan's great-great-grandfather, who he was the comeback of, his great-grandfather, not great-great, his great-grandfather, had been loading cedar poles onto a railway car, and along came a boom and knocked him down onto the ground, and he fell flat on his chest, and they thought he was dead. He wasn't moving whatsoever. When they turned him over, his chest had been punctured at just that spot, and he survived. That wasn't fatal, but it was a major. He was in the hospital for a very long time after that that accident, and so it was a major impact on his life. And so Nathan was wanting to make sure that people noticed this birthmark that he had on his chest. And he was just a very also precocious, and that's another feature of a lot of cases. You know, spoke early, said, you know, and when he was only 16 months old, you know, less than two, he went with his grandfather and his great grandmother, the widow of the person he was to come back of, to his a great-grandfather's traditional fishing site along the Skeena River.
Mm-hmm.
And at that site, there was a smokehouse. And Nathan was so upset. He said that it wasn't in as good shape as it should be. He was telling people all about, you know, it wasn't right. And he saw his boots, great big tall fishing boots that had belonged to his great grandfather were still there, and they were all dusty and old and falling apart, and he was upset about that too. So his great grandmother took them and burned them so that they would go to the spirit world, and the aspect of her late husband could enjoy them there. But then Nathan was just amazing. He began pointing out all the currents in the river and how you had to set the nets and how you have to watch out for the back currents and doing, he was just totally in charge, like he was the head chief, as his great grandfather had been, of that fishing site.
And was how old at that?
Pardon?
How old was he at that point?
He was, somewhere between 16 and 18 months, really little.
Mm-hmm.
Really little, but he just, he acted this part of the head chief.
Well, one thing that you said that was interesting to us is that one of the pieces of evidence is that these children behave and view the world from the perspective of the person they have reincarnated as.
Exactly.
I mean, they take that way of looking at the world, to put it clearly.
Really, 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 really. And Nathan did that in all kinds of ways. He did it, not only at the smokehouse, but in farther away at his grandfather's smokehouse. He would go and tell them how they should be doing the fish, and he would correct them if they didn't do it the right way, and all kinds of things like that. He also said, when he saw the first time he saw a helicopter, he said, "I've been in one of those." And of course, Nathan hadn't this life, but in this previous life as head chief of his Gitsan house, he had been taken up in a helicopter to point so he could point out the boundaries between the different head chief's territories making a map for the Delgamuukw Land Claims Court case. So he was, completely correct about that. And then while we were there, when he was 3 years old, he was giving his grandfather a lesson about how to survive a bear attack. And his grandfather said, "Well, I'm going in the car." But Nathan said, "Well, you remember you went off in the car and you had a flat tire? If you're along the highway, you have a flat tire, you can go out to change it, and a bear can come and attack you, and this is what you do." And then he gave this complete demonstration of, you put your backpack behind your neck, you look really fierce, you just stand off that bear. And he just gave a wonderful demonstration of exactly what to do.
Oh, yeah. He says, "Just don't run." And he even talked about the right way to pick berries at another circumstance.
To pick berries.
With his granddaddy.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some wisdom from his past.
He was just amazing. Amazing detail that he gave for all of these kinds of things. Yeah.
Did he have any birthmarks other than the one you've told about on the chest, like earrings?
No.
or anything like that? I know some of the cases had pierced ears from the past. It looked as though it was from the past life.
Exactly. Definitely from past lives. And there are a lot of cases that one of the chapters that I have in the Amerindian Rebirth book is about pierced ear birthmarks. But no, his great grandfather didn't have pierced ears, and so he didn't either.
Either. Oh, it's good.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Oh. It used to be that they would pierce the ears of somebody who was in line to become a head chief. The first one would be done when they were quite small, and sometimes, they would end up with a number of pierced earmarks going up their ears. And as you've doubtless seen in the Amerindian Rebirth book, there's a whole chapter with photographs of those cases. And occasionally it still happens. I'm hearing now about more new cases of children being born with pierced ear birthmarks.
Mm-hmm.
And though I said, I'm retired, I was in the First Nations Center at UNBC a few weeks back, and there were three Gitsan young women who are students at UNBC, and we got to talking about reincarnation, they started talking about all kinds of new cases. And I said, hey, would you like me to do a directed reading course on reincarnation with you? And they said, yes. Yeah. So I asked the department if I could do that. I said, you know, I'd do it for free. And they said, no, we'll pay you. So I am going to be teaching that in the
That's great.
The semester. Isn't that fun?
Oh, yeah. That if you know, Dr. Mills, there was one case in India where the little girl at 9 months old tried to let her family know that she was the widow of a man who actually lived not too far away and that she had children. I was so amazed at what she could do at 9 years old. Do you remember that particular case? I don't have her name.
Rena.
Rena. That's Rena's case.
She was looking for her twin Meg.
That was so detailed. Yes. And how the little girl behaved as a widow. Could you talk about
and you know, her mother was amazed at this, you know, small child had knowledge about sexual activity. She wasn't like a, you know, the normal little one. And you know, and then that man, her former husband, actually came to their house. He was selling tea or something, and she completely recognized him. and it was amazing. And I don't know if you know that when I did a sort of longitudinal study, it was interesting to see that in two of the cases in India, the person who had such strong memories of a previous life, you know, where they were married, Rena was one of them where she refused the arranged marriage that her parents set up because she was still in love with her previous husband.
That is so amazing. Well, there were so many details. She even followed the traditions of that culture and how she behaved as a widow when he came.
Yes.
Yeah. And she had had a phobia of needles because in her previous life she had been injected with something and had a terrible allergic reaction to it.
And that's how she died.
Talked about her cremation and was scared to death.
She had this complete phobia of receiving injection, refused to get injections in general. Yeah.
Very a piece of evidence, I thought, that she absolutely had the phobia of what had killed her in the last life.
Really? And that's one of the features that shows up in these reincarnation cases, phobias and philias. And, you know, sometimes it will be, for example, of water for someone who drowns, that kind of thing.
Mm.
You know, cause of death. Yeah. That was very, 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 very pronounced in Rena's case.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about different kinds of evidence, but I just want to say to our listeners, and what they probably already know, is that Ian Stevenson had developed very precise methods, which you follow very precisely in your research, and which makes all of this much more convincing when you read the case studies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I really recommend that people go and look up Ian Stevenson's work. It's profound and wonderful work. He had two huge volumes on cases with birthmarks and birth defects that relate to something that happened, you know, the cause of death or a serious accident in the previous life. You know, for example, a child, a newborn coming back with a very, very deformed hand without fingers, and that child talking about somebody that was completely unknown to his family, who in the previous life had his fingers chopped off by this thrashing machine.
Oof. You know, one thing that I was impressed with is that you stated that given the work that you have done with reincarnation, that you yourself began to accept the belief because there was just so much evidence to support it.
Right.
I was very pleased that as a scholar you did that. And I read that correctly, right?
You definitely did. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, yeah. You know, when the Beaver Indians introduced me to the concept, I was a little slow, because it was not something that I was used to thinking in those terms. And mm-hmm. I remember when we were there for the whole year of 65, 66, and I'd hear about reincarnation, sometimes a new baby would be born, and both little children and the elders would say, you know, what person this was, come back. And I wrote to my parents and said, what do you think about reincarnation? And my mother had a sense of humor, and she wrote back and she said the Protestant work ethic was her religion, and she'd never thought about reincarnation.
Yeah, well, there are lots of things in our culture we haven't thought much about.
Oh, yeah. Really, really, really. But my dad wrote back and saying that when he was in university, he'd read the Bhagavad Gita, and he had concluded that if there is life after birth, there must be a life. If there is life after death, there must be life before birth.
That was a good one.
Yeah, that was good. I love that.
Okay. And I took that as the green light to listen to what they had to say.
Yeah, that's good.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Another item that we wanted to ask you about is examples of the deceased Gitsan grandmother appearing before her grandchildren when they were in dire medical need.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. There's some really, really poignant examples. And I'm not sure if I published that yet, but I'm working on a book called That's My Chair, Rebirth Experience of the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en. And those examples are definitely going to be in that book. This elder woman had passed away, and she was just so proud and so, delighted with all of her grandchildren. When I went there, even that very first time in 1984, every grandchild that came into the room, she'd say, and this is, and she would tell me the whole story about who it was before. You know, so, she passed on, and then some of her grandchildren had these major medical difficulties. One of them, a woman, you know, who is a mother. I think she may have already been a grandmother when it happened. She has a medical condition, and she had a kind of like a seizure, and she fell over the railing of her balcony, which was up a floor, all the way down to the ground, and she was there, you know, in dire straits, both from the fall, as well as what had prompted her fall. And it was so reassuring for her grandmother to appear to her in spirit and say, it's all right. You're going to be fine. Don't worry. You're going to be fine. And she was.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And that is a dimension of reality that we need to be in touch with. We would.
Yeah. And I want to point out that, that not only happened to her, but another one of a grandson, he was hit by a pickup truck, by somebody by his cousin who was kind of inebriated on New Year's Eve and seriously damaged. So he was, you know, taken to the hospital and, but it was so serious that they had to fly him all the way down to the Vancouver hospital. It has more emergency, abilities. And, you know, it was really serious. It was, you know, life and death. And while he was in the operating room where they were trying to put him back together, he also experienced his grandmother coming and telling him, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. And
beautiful.
Yes, and he is fine now. You know, he never guessed that he had been, you know, had gone through such an experience. But shall I add to that, onto this?
We have only 4 minutes, I think.
Okay, well, let me just say that his grandmother had also been reincarnated as this little girl. And when that little girl saw his cousin who had hit him with the pickup truck, she just, this was when she was, you know, less than two, she went up to him and she was just kicking him in the shins. She was so unhappy with him.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
Oh, that was not all right.
Oh, that's so nice.
Well, Dr. Bills, Kim is going to ask you some questions to finish up, but I just want, I think we have only 2 minutes. I want to thank you so much for being our guest and also for your work. It's a very significant body of work. And Kim?
And very interesting body of work,
yes,
I might
is.
Add. So I'd also like to thank our Signs of Life listeners for choosing to spend time with us today for this special time we had with Dr. Antonia Mills. And Dr. Mills, if you wouldn't mind, you can have the last 2 minutes or so to leave some parting wisdom and thoughts for the audience, as well as let them know how they can find out more about your work.
Well, I think this research is really important, and I recommend that people look at Ian Stevenson's work. You can, you know, if you Google Ian Stevenson and Division of Perceptual Studies or Ian Stevenson on UVA, you'll come up with information. I looked on the UNBC website. Now that I'm a professor emerita, the list of my publications doesn't come up there. So, but Wikipedia did better.
Good Wikipedia.
Now that I saw that there isn't a link to my publications on the UNBC website, I'm going to go and ask the secretary if we can get that back up again, and I'm sure we can.
So, when is your new book going to be published, and where would you be able to find that?
I haven't. I'm still working on it,
okay.
So I haven't actually, you know, begun soliciting publishers yet. You know, I published with UBC Press, the University of Toronto Press. It'll probably be one or the other of those, so I'm not absolutely certain.
Well, they can put your name in on Amazon and in Google and whatever search
yes.
engines they want to find out what you're up to. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, because I think it's important that people understand what this the implications of reincarnation are immense, and it's fitting that just as the Standing Rock Sioux conflict is coming out, and the buffalo all came that we're talking about this topic. So
yeah.
Thanks for your interest.
Well, it's certainly significant on many levels. And so thank you and all the best in your future work.
Right. Bye, Dr. Mills.
Bye-bye. Thank you.